luistert naar De Linkse Revolte, de podcast waarin we verkennen hoe links de politieke macht van Nederland wordt. En ik zit hier samen met Tim.
Hoi, hoi.
En vandaag gaan we het wetenschappelijk onderbouwde antwoord geven op de vraag hoe links kan winnen. Eindelijk. Wat wetenschappelijk bewijs daarvoor. We don't believe you, cause we the people are still here in the rear. Yo, we don't... En dat doen we met niemand minder dan de Duitse politicoloog Tarek Abu Shadi. Tarek spreekt geen Nederlands, dus we gaan overschakelen op het Engels. Dus dat zijn een Duitser, een Vlaming en een Nederlander.
Ja.
Samen Engels praten.
Ja, Tarek, I'm Flemish, so normally I need to excuse myself for my crappy accent, and now I need to excuse myself for my crappy English, but I'm gonna do my best.
Yeah, so if you have any complaints, you can email them to our email address and we won't answer them.
Not in English, no. Yeah.
If you want to discuss everything you hear with us, you can always contact us on our platform vriendvandeshow.nl/delinksrevolte. Or through our Instagram or YouTube channels. It's at The Linkse Revolte. There you can find us. And you can always contact us classically through email. All right. Welcome, Tarek.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. We're happy to have you here, or to have you here.
Yeah, it's an honor.
We are currently at the NIAS, the Netherlands Institute for Advanced Studies in Amsterdam, where you are a visiting fellow. Right?
Right. I'm a summer fellow right now for 2 weeks, and I was a fellow here actually last year in fall for 4 months.
Okay, and what are you researching over here?
So we're currently working on a book on social democratic parties and what can explain their dwindling success, especially in the last 20 years, but also what can explain variation into where they still are in power versus where they've lost out or imploded.
Okay, so it's a sort of international comparison of all the social democratic parties in the past 20 years.
Not all of them. We're not that ambitious. We're not writing the 1500 pages of Magnus Opum. But we are focusing on Northwestern Europe, I would say. So we focus really on these countries that have fully developed multi-party systems. So we don't ask the question really anymore in the book, how can you fend off a radical right challenger? How can you fend off a Green Party challenger? But we just say, we take it as a given that they exist. And then we try to track the changes in party competition and voting behavior that then have led to different outcomes.
Okay, nice. So we're going to talk a lot about the big questions that are always dividing the left, like how do we win back the working class voter? And of course, what can be learned from the big wins in the UK and France? And the question, does the left need to be more conservative on social cultural topics? Also a very relevant one we discussed in previous episodes. But before we dive into the heavy stuff, I would like to ask you, why this fascination with the left? Is this something personal? You're really engaged with how left politics is going?
I guess it's fair to say that I am, that's where I see myself politically as well. But I haven't really started out with the left, but I rather started out with the radical right, so where I wouldn't see myself politically. But then got more and more involved in studying the left, so social democratic and green parties, really in their relationship also to the radical right. And I'm sure there's a narrative we'll talk about that is this relationship between, on the one hand, radical right success and the decline of social democratic parties. On the other hand, that really inspired our research because we thought already when we started out that what we know from social science research, and most of that actually speaks against this narrative. So we wanted to know more about this, and then we got more interested and started working on it. And we did this at a time when really that narrative of the crisis of social democracy became so so present everywhere in the world. And it was in 2016, Brexit, Trump election, and then in 2017, big losses for the German social democrats. And so there was really this idea, there is a crisis of social democracy, and most commentators had a similar answer. We thought the answer wasn't correct. And so that's really what inspired us to do more research on this and then also try to communicate it with the broader public.
And what was that simple answer then?
So the simple answer was really social democrats had lost the working class to the radical right. The radical right today is the biggest representative of the working class. And the reason for this is that social democrats have shifted their position to, especially a too progressive position on cultural issues. I'm sure we'll talk about this more. And this was the narrative that because of this, they had lost the working class, especially to the radical right. And I think we've since then, basically, you see an op-ed column on this topic in more or less that style every week in nearly all countries in Europe.
Yeah, we're really familiar.
Yeah, we are.
Because what? Let's explain to the listeners what we wanted to do with you today. Because your work it's full of myths that are busted about the left, and we would like to explore. I think four of these myths that are also really present in the debate in the Netherlands. And we were already talking about myth number one, so I would say we should continue that conversation. What strikes me is that you say the crisis of social democracy, you place it somewhere around 2016. In the Netherlands, it was with the Fortuyn Revolte. It's the whole why this podcast is called the Linkse Revolte. It's somewhere around the zeros, I think, start of the zeros. So we're in this debate now, I think about 24 years. And still a lot of people think the PvdA, especially Social Democratic Party, has lost a lot of white working class voters to the radical right. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is that is a myth. That's not true.
Exactly. So first on the crisis narrative, of course, that has also been around for a long time. There were in the 1980s in some countries already, there was a big discussion about the crisis of social democracy. For example, in Germany, the SPD was really not doing well in the 1980s and early 1990s. The same in the UK, right? Thatcherism, Reaganism, all these things were the dominant forces. And already then people were talking about the crisis of the left or social democracy. So that question is a very old one. But there was this new, it was revived through a certain lens, really, with the radical right in combination, where I think a crucial moment was 2016. Now, on the question, is that true? Right? So a very simple question, have social democratic parties lost the working class to the radical right? Which has two sub-questions in a way. The first, have they lost overproportionately the working class? And second, have they lost voters to the radical right? We've looked at this, we've done extensive research on this, really, we've kind of collected all available data on that question that allows us to track vote switching. So how people switch from one election to the next. And then we can ask, well, where did those former Social Democrats go and who was more likely to leave? And what we find, if you look at the last 20 years, is that Social Democrats did not overproportionately lose the working class. Social Democrats really lost among all social groups and in kind of all directions. I think this is something we need to be aware of, which is also clear why there is no monocausal explanation and also not a monocausal solution for the problem. If anything, they slightly overproportionately lost educated women. Again, if you think about this, the narrative already is quite of a different one.
Yeah.
And then we can see who did they lose their voters to? Who did they lose the most voters to? And there we see that really only a small share of former Social Democrats went to the radical right. Depending on how we put the countries together, maybe 10-15% only.
But that's not only the working class then?
No, that's not only the working class.
Yeah, okay.
But even among the working class, it is only a smaller proportion. Even among the working class, certainly a lot more people went to the mainstream right, to the center right. Mm-hmm. And even there, about the same amount went to more left libertarian, also radical left parties and so on. So even among the working class, losses to the radical right are overrepresented, but they're not the plurality of losses at all. So there's just no evidence for this.
Okay, and if you look to the Netherlands, I think the share of votes the left as a whole has won in the last election. It's never been so small in modern history. Mm-hmm. Where did these voters go? It's to the middle, you're saying.
Exactly. So of course the Netherlands is a difficult system in that regard because you have so many parties, and then the question is where do you put parties in the center?
Right? Yeah, there's
exactly, right? Well, as what do we classify them? And then this gets more complicated. But it's certainly these direct changes to the radical right, we don't observe. And also in the Netherlands, if you go back, if you look at this, really, the implosion in 2017, the big losses of the Pivandar happened to D66. They went to Junlinks, and they didn't go to the PVV at the time. And this is the same is true in France when the Parti Socialiste imploded in 2017. There too, Macron in that election won more former Parti Socialiste voters than Benoît Hamon and Jean-Luc Mélenchon, so the PS candidate in that election and the LFE candidate together. So they went to Macron. Now, how we classify Macron, again, very difficult, also probably changed in the last 7 years. But certainly in 2017, he wasn't a socially conservative candidate. He was very pro-European. He had various, you know, kind of like young progressive way of talking and presenting himself.
Yeah.
So there too, really, there wasn't these losses to the Rassemblement National. If I can add one thing, there's research that my colleagues, Daniel Bischoff and Thomas Kura, have done on this. And they use run-longing panel data. There are three countries in Europe that have these really long-running panels. So looking at the same people that participate in surveys regularly over a long period of time. That is the UK, Switzerland, and Germany. And there, too, they don't find that today's radical right voters are former Social Democrats. Only a small share has gone to the radical right. And there, what you can track is not only the direct switching, but you can also track these trajectories of, let's say, social democracy to abstention or to the mainstream right and then to the radical right. That too is a rare occasion. We don't say this doesn't happen at all, but this is not what can explain the electoral crisis of social democracy today.
Yeah, but that's something I would think, because the disappointed PvdA voters, I would think that the biggest portion left the PvdA in the 90s when the third way was introduced.
Yeah.
And I would guess they would become non-voters, disillusioned, and then 20 years later they end up on the radical right. But yeah. that's already.
So in the countries where we can study this, that's not the case. Germany is a good case to look at this because the radical right is quite new. Right, yeah. So we can really look at them today and see where do these voters come from. And they aren't necessarily, or only to a small share, former Social Democrats. Also, I know that this is an appealing narrative, but this makes a lot of sense. But if you think about it, think of a voter in 1994. And let's say at the time, the average Social Democratic voter was 45 years old. Which is probably young for social democrats, but let's say they were 45 years old.
Yeah, we're
right. So this is 30 years ago. 1994 is now 30 years ago. So the average is now 75. Yeah. So we know that a significant share of these voters has passed away. These voters cannot explain the current electoral situation well. Generally, when looking at social democrats, the focus is much too strongly on who they've lost. And much too little on who they haven't gained. Why, among especially young people, social democracy is basically non-existent. And that is a big challenge for them, right? So in these new milieus and changing milieus, also in the new working class, social democracy doesn't have support. But we still constantly thinking of these, when we say working class, right, what people actually mean are men in the industrial working class. That's what they think about, and this is why this narrative of the left behind exists.
Yeah.
And of course, most industrial workers today aren't the left behind at all. They're actually quite well protected. They actually make more money than people in many other professions.
So who is the modern working class, according to you?
Well, many people in especially, of course, the service sector, right? This is a big change there, right? So then we already see they're much more likely to be women. They're more likely to have migration background, be non-white, and so on. And that class, of course, many of them just don't vote at all. Many of them don't have the right to vote. And so we already see then, if we think about working class representation that way, then it's not that everything's great for social democracy, not at all. But the questions that we need to answer are fundamentally different then.
Okay, but if I understand you good, I'm going to try to understand you good. Like, we have now this fixation about the working class isn't represented anymore within our party. And you say, okay, but they did not all walk away. I mean, every social group in our party walked away, and they did not walk away to the radical right. And since our electorate is on the verge of extinction, we should focus more on young people, and maybe instead of working class, maybe focusing more on labor conditions.
Yeah, so the question, of course, if you look at it generationally, then the perspective really changes, right? If you look at, if you have people who are 25, 30, then we know half of them is going to university, right? So going to university, that the median voter in that age group goes to university. So going to university is not a small elite group anymore. This doesn't mean social democrats should represent the working class, right? The left should represent the working class. This is their idea.
Yeah,
this is their ideology. This is why they exist, yeah. And this should continue. But what they've gotten into their head is a wrong idea of who they are representing, who they should be appealing to, and why they've lost them. And because of this, they're in this cycle that makes them make decisions that are actually not beneficial to them, and they're not getting any working class representation back. Also, what we shouldn't forget is that there's always been a share of the working class that didn't support the left. There's always been a share of the working class that supported the right, whatever form it had. And so this will always exist. And yes, today, a significant share of the working class supports the radical right. But this is something that has, in one way or another, always existed.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's hardly impossible to be presented at a gathering of my party, Social Democrats, without at least five people saying, yeah, but working class isn't represented in this room. Mm-hmm. How do we deal with that?
Yes, so this is a different question, and one that's very important. What we in political science would refer to as descriptive representation. So are certain social characteristics represented in parliaments, in political parties, among the people who are engaged? And yes, there we have seen a decline, and I think that decline is a problem for social democratic parties. Again, there, for certain groups of the working class, we've basically never have had representation. The working class that was represented was, again, industrial working class that was well organized within unions and so on. Having a, let's say, a cleaner, a waiter, someone like that, getting into a leadership position in social democratic parties was a very, very rare occasion.
Yeah.
So we need to ask this question, why they aren't there. And then, of course, we have a lot of structural challenges, which I would argue have very little to do with the question if social democracy talks too much, too little about certain type of topics,
yeah,
and has many different organizational structural responses that we need to find to that.
Okay, question. But is there maybe a clearer distinction to understand the gap in between who we are doing it for and who we are ourselves, maybe educational level?
Yes, so there's a huge gap. That is true. That is true for basically all parties. Politicians are much more educated than the public on average. And now we can try to find reasons for this, right? One is, in a way, it's obvious to think of being a politician as some sort of high-skilled education that needs a certain level of education.
Yeah.
We might say that's not true, it shouldn't be the case, but then we need to ask ourselves, how do we get to a structure where that doesn't happen? Of course, the occupational profile of politicians has also changed. And so now you have a lot of people running for parliament who have long been in professions, and I know this best from the UK, but I think it's true in other countries too, who have been in professions that are just close to politics.
Yeah, yeah.
And these are the people who then become politicians. And that, of course, then is strongly correlated with education. Massive problem, of course, is the kind of unions, right? Unions were really the channel through which workers found their way into politics.
Yeah.
And if you look at the UK, Angela Rayner is, of course, a great example of now a powerful working class woman in the Labour Party. And she really came through a union and through union work. But this, I mean, working class women is, of course, an even bigger exception. But this was also historically the case. Working class women were very, very rare in politics.
And when such people break through, they're often really successful immediately, right? When a working class woman enters a party as a representative, it really works. Do you have proof for that? The literal descriptive representation is a success factor?
Well, it makes sense to me because if you break through as a working class woman, then you just have to be really, really good, right? And so then it does make sense to me that they're, because they face so many hurdles before, that then the ones that we get to know as the broader public are probably really, really good at what they're doing.
Yeah, but I have to admit, till the age of 32, I wasn't highly educated. I started university at an old age, a relatively old age. So I was a dishwasher for like 15 years. And I totally get what you mean. I didn't feel represented at all. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I thought the topics they were discussing about, I mean, I was always a social democrat, but everything I needed, like the basic, they weren't discussing that anymore. Like good housing, good wage, social protection. Yeah. That they gave it away or something. But now I'm like the director of the think tank of the Social Democrats. So I've been a long way. And what I see is that sometimes I really feel they don't understand these lower class people anymore. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me a big problem. The problem is not the highly educated are overrepresented. I don't see that as a problem because you can be highly educated, still have a good heart, and because of your own good position, want to do everything to help the working class. Huh? Yeah. But I think the main problem is they simply don't understand the working class anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's in language, that's in proposals of legislation and so on and so on. How do you look at that?
So it is true that, right, especially in the 90s and early 2000s, Social Democrats have actively decided not to speak the language of the working class anymore. I think when we say this now, what people think of is using gender inclusive language and things like this. That's not at all what I mean. What they've decided then is to deliberately not use a language of class in politics anymore. They've deliberately decided to move away from ideology and have decided to become more managerial parties. And I think this is something that is understudied in the legacy of these 90s, early 2000s, New Labour, Neue Mitte types, because there's a strong focus on the economic ideology, the neoliberalism, if you want to call it like that.
Yeah. And politicians have become more kind of problem solvers instead of leaders of the struggle or something.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So they style themselves as, solving problems, kind of managers of certain types of issues. Mark Rutte was best example for this, by being purely non-ideological in his language and presentation, of course, being very ideological and changing the position of the VVD on certain issues. But Social Democrats have given up on class politics and they've given up on identity politics. And I think this is one of the big misunderstandings of our time. That, right, again, this narrative, and I think, right, this is one of the myths.
Yeah, we really we'll naturally to this, flow yes, towards
the next myth. I still have one question about the language.
Ah, Tim.
Yeah, this is a reoccurring theme, because Hans is always using quite nice language, and I'm the dude who says bullshit from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Tim doesn't want me to mention the word capitalism.
I'm like quite straightforward if I talk, and I sometimes use the word bullshit because sometimes something is really bullshit, and then you don't have to say like this is maybe not inappropriate. No, you can just tell this is bullshit and we don't take it anymore.
Yeah. So I think few people say you can't swear or use, straight out direct language. I'm the first person in my family to go to university. And I know that people in different contexts speak differently, right? At an Oxford High table, the way people speak is different compared to where I'm from or when I, hang out with my friends in Berlin in a club, right? Mm-hmm. The way you speak is different. But there have always been norms around how you speak about certain topics. And then I also know that, for example, I'm a person of color, and I know how all my life, when people use certain words, this has been incredibly hurtful. It's been incredibly othering, again, to use one of these, fancy language words, but it's just given me the feeling that I don't belong to a group that I technically belong to.
Yeah, I totally understand. And I have the same feeling.
What kind of words are we thinking about?
Just words that have not been seen as insulting people maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago, about people of color, about women, about, you know, LGBT people and so on. And where now a lot of these discussions on, you know, political correctness and so on as canceling whatever, all of this bullshit is that that's this now.
Okay, but I heard you're talking about going to a club in Berlin. I had my one of my craziest club experiences was in Berlin in the Kit Kat Club.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna tell what kind of club it is. It was a really good party though, but and I went with the Freaks bus, so I didn't took a plane to go to Berlin. Yeah. I'm,
plus one for Tim.
But sometimes, and I told this already in a former part of the podcast, but maybe we need to go to clubs more often, and maybe we need to go to just like this regular bars more often and talk with people, because everybody goes to a club.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly
not, see you laughing.
I'm certainly not guilty of not going enough to Berlin clubs. But the I can use this to make a point I like to make, and this is again if we think about the left behind today and the people that the left should represent. Again, this image is, you know, the straight white dude working in the industry. And it's not a trans waitress in a big city.
Yeah, on a flex job with minimum wage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And those, you may be more likely to meet at a club if you go to a club. And I would really recommend having that conversation about, you know, privilege and really being left behind and really being excluded to social democratic politicians, because again, that is also a language they don't speak. These are also people who are not represented. These are also people they don't understand.
Okay, and one last question on this topic, but if we wanted to do some field work in Berlin, which club should you recommend?
This is for our listeners.
I know you can call in and then you'll get, you know, 4 guest list spots to Berghain for the podcast.
Okay, we gotta remember.
Maybe we can do this as a prize for our listeners. Sure. We were already kind of discussing the next myth number 2. But it's a little bit more nuanced. Namely, it's often I hear people say the left should avoid discussing racism or gender-related discrimination because it only divides our potential electorate. Instead, we should only talk about socioeconomic problems. So it's a little bit more nuanced here. Doesn't say we should weaken our social cultural position, but we just shouldn't talk about it too much.
Try to avoid it all the time.
Yeah, to avoid putting the focus on that topic that divides our electorate. Mm-hmm.
So first of all, I understand where that impetus comes from. Right? You think back of a time when politics was just about the economy and the left was doing well. Mm-hmm. And there is evidence for this, right? A kind of a, let's say, one-dimensional political space where you have the left and the right. One side is for redistribution and, you know, wants to fight inequality. The other side is for market forces and so on. That kind of electorally helps the left.
Yeah.
This time basically never existed. There was maybe one short period after the Second World War, maybe for 15 years, maybe 20 years, where this was mostly an accurate description of politics. But in many countries, I mean, in the Netherlands, for example, this wasn't, religion was always a main topic, right? And then that resulted in how the party system worked in the Netherlands. Obviously, questions such as female suffrage were a main topic of the left before. I want to say that time never really existed. It's certainly not going to come back. These so-called cultural issues are fundamental issues of social justice. It's impossible to just separate issues into material and post-material.
Yeah.
Right? Where to put in, you know, the major challenge for humanity at the moment, that is climate change. Right? Obviously, this is something that is fundamentally material, and yet new issues always create trade-offs.
Yeah, new divisions. Yeah.
That is just the nature of politics where we are. So we are in a multi-issue space, which is why we see in electoral systems that allow this fragmentation, high levels of fragmentation, right? again, how many party groups in the Netherlands right now? 16 or so in Parliament?
That's constantly changing.
It's like the weather.
Right? But so that is a trend we see everywhere, and this has something to do with it. So this time is not going to come back. And now if we look at the problems I just talked about that social democratic parties have, especially generationally, age-wise, right? Their voters being really, really old. And if you just take the PvdA and then you leave GroenLinks out, then we know this is a massive problem in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think these young voters are going to come back to social democratic parties? If you do not say anything about the main issues that are on their mind, and that is just the case for many of them. Not everyone under 25 is woke, that's certainly true. But that these questions are on their mind and that the left cannot withdraw in also trying to shape the narrative around these issues, to explain to people why this is important, why this is a question of social justice, and why economic and these so-called cultural issues are fundamentally linked and belong together. If they don't do that, they will not win this debate. And the radical right is very willing to jump in and shape issues in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you always say, like in the Netherlands, a term that is really central in the debate is bestaanszekerheid, mm-hmm. being sure
livelihood, to exist. Security.
Livelihood.
Yeah, livelihood.
You always say, Tim, racism is bestaanszekerheid. You can't. It's weird to decouple those things. Yeah.
Yeah. If you have to do with racism, discrimination, sexism, that's livelihood insecurity, and we have to explain it like that. But we always go into the narrative of livelihood security is just about your wage and having good labor conditions, but it's also about not being discriminated. If you can't find a job because of your back name, yeah, you got a big problem.
There was a similar thing that happened in Germany around this. Respect, right, which was a big slogan of Olaf Scholz. And if you talk to social Democrats, and they think they won the election because of that great slogan.
Yep.
And again, there was also an unwillingness to use this to think of these other dimensions of inequality and discrimination. And there's been there is always this fall back into the socioeconomic way of looking at the world. And why? Because again, who are active, powerful, social democratic politicians? They're very often not the people who have made the experiences of discrimination on other kinds of dimensions. And so they, in a way, they let the repertoire to make these connections, which again is what brings me back to the importance of young people really being involved in political parties and really being listened to and not being told, you know, we know it better. You know, we won this election 27 years ago, so we know how it works.
We know what we do.
Yeah, that's the main problem, though. But don't start to, don't go that way. But if I listen good, like we had the first myth with working class voters going to the right. Mm-hmm. It's nonsense. Second myth, leave the sociocultural topics aside, that's mm-hmm. nonsense. But with two myths, with your explanation of it, I'm thinking of the word solidarity. Mm-hmm. That's maybe our main value, then, being solidar with the people, lower class people, but also with people who are not, different. And I mean this in a respectful way. So solidarity should be. You say respect, I say solidarity.
Yes, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. I would always say I leave the, you know, putting it into slogans. I leave these people who are actually good at this. No, I mean, there are people who are great at this. I don't think that's me. I think my job starts at a bit of a different position. But what I can say is that what our research shows is there's less of these material versus post-material, economic versus cultural trade-offs than we might think, right? There is this strong, again, narrative that is this kind of this dividing line. We have the educated middle class who are culturally progressive but don't want a lot of redistribution because they're kind of, you know, they make nothing income. Mm. And then there is the working class that is poorer, is economically left, and but authoritarian nationalist in their ideas. And many of this is just not true. We don't find that this is so true, that there is this socioeconomic determinism of these class groups and these attitudes. We've done a lot of active research on this. So, for example, what we've done in six countries is we let people pick between different social democratic programs, right? Kind of an experiment and a survey. And they got these pairs of programs, of course, not full programs reading 90 pages, but very stylized on 9 dimensions, you know, inheritance, taxation, rent control, climate change, immigration, and so on. And then it's called a conjoint experiment in social science. You can determine which issues, right, which positions affect if a program is chosen or not.
Yeah.
And what we find is that people who are economically left-wing prefer culturally progressive programs, and those who are culturally progressive prefer economically left-wing programs. So we do not find this dividing line. There are some reasons for this. One is that people who are less educated and left-wing, who are, again, the people who would be think to be a bit more authoritarian on certain dimensions, they mostly pick programs based on the economy. So for them, as long as a program is economically left-wing, they don't care so much what it says about, you know, let's say gender parity on boards of companies or immigration.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, the people who are culturally more progressive, higher educated, they are more likely to pick a program based on these cultural issues.
Yeah.
That is at least true for the potential social democratic electorate. There are some people in the electorate who are, you know, strong far-right supporters, would never vote for a social democratic party. For them, it's different. But if you look at the people who would maybe ever consider voting for the left for social democracy, then that pattern that I just described holds.
Okay, but then the task would be like to address both the socio-economic issues and the social-cultural issues, but in kind of a balanced way, which is maybe today not always the case.
So this, I think, again, this is a myth in the sense that, and this is such a dangerous myth because we really imported this from the right. The idea that the left mostly talks about gender equality, LGBT rights, kind of these non-material cultural issues is simply empirically wrong.
It's an additional myth, Tim.
Yeah, but okay, it could be.
The economy is by far still, if you look at what parties talk about, by far the number one issue. And then there are things like health and education and so on. This is all not gender equality. And again, try to find a social democratic politician in Europe who says something like structural racism, right? This is so rare. This debate really does not exist in social democratic parties. And there's a tiny bit of emphasis on it. But it really, this idea that what social democrats have changed, again, we have evidence for this, is they talk more about immigration, but not in the sense of they talk about how important immigration is for the labor market and how we, you know, have to take in asylum seekers to uphold international law and so on. No, they've adjusted to the rhetoric and the positions of the radical right. They have moved to the radical right. They're now also competing about who's best at deporting people. So they talk more about immigration a lot more, but not in a progressive sense, but they've really just shifted to the radical right.
Okay, but I talked with somebody living in a poor neighborhood a couple of weeks ago, a lot of people with migration background. Mm-hmm. And she told me like, it's okay, this LGBTQ, and it's okay, it's very important. Everybody needs to have his place in society, but why don't you talk about my place in society? I'm a Muslim girl, BVV is the biggest party. I don't feel safe as well. And what you are doing as politic party in my poor neighborhood is talking about LGBT people had to have their place in society as well. I can imagine that's something like, well, do you really forgot my situation? Do you really forgot who I am? And just talking about these other groups, like I'm not part of it anymore.
I would agree with her that the left has not stood up for the Muslim population in Europe. That is I certainly agree with her that in that sense, she is a forgotten girl. Mm. And it is the product of the left strategically responding to exactly these narratives that we talked about. So that left-wing politicians, again, this is much more true for the Social Democrats than for the Greens, but the Greens have started doing similar things in many European countries, that they thought we're losing all these voters to the radical right. The radical right is doing better and better. So we also need to talk about immigration as a problem.
Yeah.
And about Islam as a problem, especially.
Yeah.
And so I 100% understand that she doesn't feel seen by the left. I don't think that the solution to this is to say the left needs to talk less about LGBT rights. I don't think that the left is talking an excessive amount about LGBT rights. Again, if you think of trans rights right now, of course, the right is talking about this 10,000 times more than the left. And there are, of course, also Muslim LGBT people. Then if we have the intersection, these are the really forgotten ones. Yeah. And the really the ones that really face the othering and then the racism and anti-LGBT attitudes and so on at the same time.
Okay, but then could it be, and that's the last question about this, because I'm really trying to think practically in here, but could it be like in a poor neighborhood you need to address other issues and try to use other narratives than in the not so poor neighborhoods? So differentiation maybe in your strategy?
Yes, right. This is this is the art of politics, that of course you need to think about first of all, you have to have an ideology. And then you have to think about...
Thank you to remind us.
Right. And then you have to think about how to make people understand that ideology. Mm. And people have different backgrounds and have made different experiences, and these experiences will matter for how they think about certain contexts. And right, this is so true for also economic issues. The left has not talked about housing basically at all in the last 30 years.
Yeah.
When I have asked social democratic politicians why they don't, their answer is basically, we don't have a solution for it. So we don't want to promise anything because we kind of know in the economic framework that we have, we cannot really fix this. And so we don't want to promise something that we can't deliver on, which has never kept the right from any political strategy.
Yeah, I know. And it's like the main issue in politics. No, you have to promise things, and afterwards you need to try to come to a consensus. And that's the reality of politics now.
It is true, but you, by telling people we care about this issue, you already signal something to them that's important to them. Say, okay, we are listening. We are putting this on the agenda. We are making this an important topic. And because the left hasn't done this, the radical right has now moved in on this issue.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Vilas has done this very successfully here. Yeah. The Portuguese radical right, for example, has also done this, Chega, by saying this is a problem of immigration, which is factually wrong. But it's, I mean...
Also, their language is a main issue, no? Because we even as lefties, we just talk about the housing market. We talk about the healthcare market. And I don't think that's suitable with our ideology. It's about housing. It's about healthcare. But those are not markets. I mean, and you can have market types of housing markets and healthcare markets. But it's not a market in its pure sense. So.
I mean, the left in power, of course, has strongly contributed to making it more markets by selling public housing. A lot in a lot of countries, so they have contributed, unfortunately, to the marketization of health, of housing, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to the next myth, because we're almost at the end of the episode already. Way too interesting. Finally, some scientific evidence for all the bold claims we make. Let's move to myth number three, and this is really relevant because we've seen this in the UK with the victory for Starmer and Labour there. And it's a question of us whether this is actually a myth, because the notion we often hear is that the left should adopt moderate views on economic topics to persuade voters in the middle. So just a bit more redistribution of wealth, but no big systemic changes in the economy, and certainly not a crusade against capitalism, just normal politics and stability. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that? Because it worked in the UK.
Yeah. I think it's a difficult question to answer, because what I'm trying not to do is to say, if you pick this kind of position, you'll definitely win in that election.
Yeah.
For that, single elections in single countries have way too many factors. And right, I could now start saying what are the relevant factors in the UK, and I don't think that Starmer's or Labour's economic position would rank in the top five in this. That said, there's of course an understanding of politics, right? It's kind of spatial idea that by moving to the center, you win more voters because in the center there are more voters.
Yeah.
This is true only under very rare conditions, and certainly not in these multi-party, multi-issue spaces that we have currently. So this is much more complicated than this. And what political parties need to answer first really is the question of who are their potentials. And there's a concept that we work with, this so-called consideration set.
Mm-hmm.
So what voters do is like a two-stage process. First, they select parties that they would potentially vote for, or they have a number of parties that they would never vote for. And then in the second step, they pick one of these parties.
Yeah.
And at different steps, different factors come in. And then these consideration sets are also more stable over time. They can change, but they don't change as much as vote choice per se.
Yeah.
And so for any kind of analysis about programmatic strategies, I think a first step needs to be to think, who has us in the consideration set? And I don't know how much parties do this internally, but when we look at how people react to just generally polling, I think this is done too rarely.
Yeah.
And then obviously, if you just look at general polls, there will always be a tendency to the center. Right, because it's just the nature of distributions.
Yeah.
But if we leave out people who will never vote for us as a political party, then this should already give us different answers in terms of where our strategies are. And so I think this is an important thing in this narrative around the center. Again, there's some good research on for example, by Björn Bremer, who's looked at the reaction of social democratic parties to the economic and financial crisis. And there's really shows that austerity, which again was the centrist idea, has really hurt social democratic parties in the process.
Yeah, in the Dutch case, it's...
To explain the term, austerity is like financial strictness, right? Just instead of...
Bezuinigen.
Bezuinigen, yeah.
No, in Germany, right? It was the Swabian housewife, right? You can't spend more than you earn.
Yeah.
And I mean... For people outside the Netherlands, I like to use to illustrate the crisis of social democracy. It's a good example to ask them which party they think Jeroen Dijsselbloem was a member of, right? And they certainly don't come up with the social democracy.
That's pretty painful. Yeah, 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 yeah. Big sigh. The question remains, why, if there are a lot of voters in the middle, you're saying a lot of voters don't even consider the left, so moving to the middle isn't an effective strategy?
So it comes with trade-offs, right? And so, of course, running on the anti-capitalist revolution, the anti-capitalist crusade, might not...
I think it's pretty niche.
that might not work out for a large party.
Yeah.
But obviously, in multi-party systems, parties exploit ever smaller niches in a way. So the question is also, who do you get to turn out, but also how do you shape a debate?
Mm.
And again, the question is coming back to certain ideological core points of that used to be part of the left. Let's think of it used to be a promise of the left that people work less. I mean, that is gone, right? That certainly disappeared a long time ago. And obviously now there are experiments with certain types of work time models. And this would just be one issue. And I'm not saying this is going to work, this is going to be the issue. But I think what's crucial is to see, maybe also to move away from this overly simple center and kind of like radical or extreme or whatever you have as the opposite. Because if you have a multi-issue space, then there is no center really, because people might not all, this is now getting very political science-y, but their preferences might not be aligned in that way on all dimensions. So someone can have a radical position on one dimension and a centrist on another. And then if we think of that person, don't we think it's more likely that they will vote on their radical position instead of their centrist one, because that might matter more to them, right? So that too really plays a role, these questions of salience, what's important in the process of voting. And it's not just where people are when they're asked, are you for more or less taxes or this and that?
Yeah. So no longer shouting for capitalism.
Still thinking it. And the problem of working less, this is something I'm always amazed by, that there is no political party pushing working less to the political agenda again, because we have one in the Netherlands alone, 1.2 million people with burnout, how do you call it, verschijnselen. This is really... But it's easy to politicize this topic and get a lot of attention, but nobody really does that.
I think the Austrian Social Democrats have this, because they have Andy Babler was they elected a very left wing leader, and so he at least it was his personal position. I don't know if they've made it an official party position, but the 4-day week really as a
But if you look at our current economical system and our society as a whole, it's just like this industry of stress.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, for capitalism could be the solution. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it takes a while, no? It's a big system to... So yeah, we need to address changes as well on like the more micro topics like you are saying. So
yeah,
you opened my eyes, Hans. I'm not really in favor of working less though, but...
give it a few months.
Yeah.
Hey, we need to wrap it up. We have one last question, but before we end it, thanks for having us. And when you're in the Netherlands again, we would love to come by again to bust some other myths with you.
Yeah, and then we're going to talk about all these changes we made because of your because of your advice.
Excellent.
Hey, one last question. Do you have a call to action? We always try to end our episode with a call to action. Do you have any appeal or advice to our listeners that you would give? And there are people who are trying to start the left-wing revolt in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's really essential that people who have ideas for change don't listen to people who tell them this is not possible for XYZ. I think people do this much too easily. And especially when I talk to young people who are really engaged in politics and are active in the left, and too often they hear, this is not possible. Or even worse, your ideas are naive because they don't work in the same construct of thinking as those currently in power. And I think this is something that's gotten worse with just aging of societies, which is a good thing, but you know, older people just being much more dominant because of this, people who have been around longer in political parties and in politics in general.
Mm.
And so these will often be the first contact points when you try to do something in politics. And I know how discouraging this can be. There's also, you know, this applies to the professors that many people will meet at university or their teachers and all of this. There's just such a high likelihood that someone will tell you, you can't do this, this doesn't work, or it's naive to think like that. And so I would encourage people to not listen to these people. And obviously the nice thing about, you know, the internet, social media, is that you can find people who really make substantiated claims that think outside the box and actually encourage that type of thinking in contrast to where the status quo is.
Okay, but that nice. That would mean for like the people I talked because of this podcast, for example, most of them older people. Like if they really want to contribute to the left revolution, they need to find young people, take them serious, go in discussion. Yep. And with their knowledge, they could be some mentoring thing or something for the young people. Like, okay, this is your crazy idea, but this is the steps you need to take to get it known in our party or something. So yeah. I see really. So to all the old listeners, be a mentor. Wow. For the young, crazy IDs.
And listen to them. I think that also makes it just your life generally probably more exciting. And
listening to people.
Listening also to listening to younger people. Yeah, and that's taking a difficult them seriously.
All right. Thanks, Derek. We had one important thing, also a call to action to our listeners, because you have created a new network, right?
Yes, we've started what's called the Progressive Politics Research Network. If you just Google this, or if you follow me on Twitter, you'll find it. We are a network of researchers with really a call to action to get research results out to a broader public, to politicians, and so on. And so we regularly publish what we call research briefs that summarize research in a way that we think is accessible and kind of, you know, makes clear points and doesn't get lost in academic language. Our first round of research briefs are exactly on these myths about the left, myths about progressive politics, and debunking some of them.
And are there myths, can you name one that we haven't discussed yet, but is really important?
So we for example, also focus on this myth of green voters, right? Are green voters more economically well off, and do they not care about redistribution? And again, we don't find that this is necessarily the case. We find that green voters are quite economically left wing, which may be less surprising in the Netherlands, but in countries like Germany, in other countries, there's a strong myth about the well off green voters who don't care about redistribution.
Nice. All right. Cool. This was a bit of a spoiler, actually. Hey, thanks for having us. And for our listeners, we see you next week at a new episode of The Klets in the Klasse. We have a lot of responses, so I think almost the whole episodes will be discussing your opinions.
Yeah, cool.
So see you then.
Thank
bye
you,
bye. So all you bad folks, you must go.